NHPR News. It's now 9:06.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and here are some of the voices from this week's top news stories.
People under 40 who may not feel the risk implied in going without health insurance. It's taken a bit longer. They're going to procrastinate a little bit more, but hopefully we'll see more of them joining the insured ranks as the deadline draws near.
It will cannibalize existing businesses. It has the crime, addiction, social costs. It doesn't raise that much revenue. Every state that's done casinos gets more addicted.
I think in my heart I made a promise that if there's anything I could do to ensure that his generation and others who have been discriminated against in the past would know that New Hampshire is their home too, and that they are full citizens with those rights to life, liberty, and happiness as well.
I think it's so exciting because essentially what we're going to do is save fuel. And when we save, obviously, energy, it's going to make it less costly for people to fly. So there are so many positives that I think that we're going to see from what you are doing here.
The behavior of using a cell phone or any sort of electronic device is dangerous. People are dying. We have fatalities because of this behavior.
From the top, that was Karen Hicks of Covering New Hampshire on Monday's last-minute enrollments under the Affordable Care Act. Steve Dupree with Casino Free New Hampshire voicing his opposition at a hearing on the latest expanded gambling bill. State Senator David Waters testifying in support of a constitutional amendment to ban discrimination based on sexual orientation. U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte speaking at the announcement of a new high-tech aerospace facility coming to Rochester. And Greenland Police Chief Tara Laurent telling the Senate Transportation Committee why she favors a bill banning cell phone use behind the wheel. Again, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you as we examine these headlines and others, including yesterday's Senate committee hearing on repealing New Hampshire's death penalty. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests for this week's roundup include Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Joining us by phone is Joanne McKenzie, New Hampshire editor for the Eagle Tribune. And Joanne, welcome to the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Good to have you.
Thanks, Laura. Good to be here.
Also with us, Norma Love, Statehouse reporter for the Associated Press. And Norma, welcome back. Nice to see you, too.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and Norma, first, let's start off with that death penalty hearing just yesterday at the Senate Judiciary Committee. Some familiar arguments were made about capital punishment, from the moral issues to the costs involved with years of legal wrangling. But yesterday, Norma, Michael Addison was also on a lot of senators' minds. Give us a little more there.
Well, I think the issue here is, how can you repeal a law and not affect someone on death row? It's really unclear to some senators whether you can do that. Former Attorney General Greg Smith made the argument that the courts would be deciding this, and they would look to the law that had been in place in enforcing the death penalty. But I think right now the Senate is so close to call. I asked one of the supporters, and she thought it was 12-12, or maybe 13-11, one way or the other. And I think that's probably right. Everybody I've talked to said it's a very close vote. And, of course, if it should pass, it would go to Maggie Hassan, who said if she's comfortable that Michael Addison's fate would not be changed, she would sign the bill, and that would repeal our death penalty. We've had not executed anybody since 1939. So it's a very emotional issue, and I really don't think we're going to know until that roll call is called who's going to vote how.
Would this be easier, Norma, for senators to decide if there were not a person actually sitting on death row? And all these questions around, if it's repealed, what that means for him.
Yes. In fact, I talked to one senator who I know will vote against repeal, who said if Michael Addison had not been convicted and sentenced to death, he might consider voting differently. But it's as I said, it's a very difficult when you have someone on death row and you have police chiefs and officers saying, hey, this is our last line of defense, that if someone kills one of us, that they are not sitting in prison for the rest of their lives. I think that's very difficult for the 24 state senators to go against.
Well, it's an odd situation, Dean Spiliotis, to be considering repeal while a person is on death row. Illinois, where you lived for a time, you know, went through a big death penalty repeal debate. I mean, there are other states that have gone through this this very difficult conversation.
Right. And if my recollection is correct, at one point the governor even put a moratorium on executions just because he was so concerned about the application of the law. You know, if you take the Addison issue is what makes this particularly interesting. It's put from a political perspective. It's put Maggie Hassan in a difficult position. She doesn't want to alienate law enforcement. But on the other hand, she has said she supports a repeal of the death penalty. If you take that out of the equation for a moment, you know, the types of arguments you're hearing or that we heard at the hearing yesterday, in which I believe a lot of people spoke in favor of repeal, but nonetheless, there were others who spoke in favor of maintaining it. You know, these are arguments I've been hearing for many, many, many years about, you know, supporters of the death penalty say it's a deterrent, that some crimes are so heinous that death is the only appropriate punishment. You know, the opponents of the death penalty say it's not a deterrent. It's unevenly applied based on race. People can be put to death when now we're finding out that often DNA evidence excludes them as the person who committed the murder or crime. So, you know, these are arguments that have been going on for a long time. You know, kind of the sort of the public opinion and the mood in the country seems to shift on this slowly over a number of decades. We seem to be going through a period now in which, in part because of what we've seen with some other states, and concerns about DNA evidence, et cetera, kind of starting to roll it back a little bit. But, you know, the sad truth is this is not the last time we will have a crime in New Hampshire that fits the current capital statute. So people, you know, we have Addison on death row, but it's not the last time something bad like that is probably going to happen in the state. So people have to be comfortable with the idea that, you know, in the future, if something similar occurs to the Addison case and you repeal the death penalty, you won't have that option as a potential punishment. And so I think Hassan is in a very tricky position right now.
Norma. I think that there are some people also who may be troubled by this whole situation, because at the same time that Michael Addison was convicted and sentenced to death, we had a case, a murder-for-hire case, a white man who was wealthy who was not sentenced to death, Mr. Brooks. And so there are people who draw comparisons, as Dean said. Is it a factor of race? I can't say it is, but I'm just saying that that is out there.
All right, and this is a story we'll definitely be following up on this Friday New Hampshire News Roundup as the Senate goes through its process. So I'm going to set it aside for now, but we will definitely be talking about this in the weeks ahead. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Join us. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange. And Joanne McKenzie, I want to turn to another bill that has gotten a lot of attention from our audience. This is a House bill to ban handheld cell phone use while driving. Now the Senate Transportation Committee is looking at it. Just remind us of what this conversation is about, Joanne.
Well, as you know, New Hampshire already bans texting while driving, but enforcement has been a real issue. The law enforcement community is not out there looking for people texting, and the number of citations for violating that law are minimal. So there are concerns that New Hampshire already has a distracted driving law. So whether you're on your phone or shaving or eating cereal, you could be cited for that. So this would ban the use of only handheld devices, and it's beyond cell phones. It's also programming your GPS or working on your laptop, presumably. So this would allow you to talk on the phone, but only hands-free.
So state police, it sounds like, or local police, already aren't pulling a lot of folks over for distracted driving and texting? Yeah.
For texting, correct. If there's an accident that results, then they're apt to look into the behavior of the driver before that crash occurred. But I believe it was well under 100 tickets written last year statewide for distracted driving. You know, and this is the live free or die state where adults are not required to wear seatbelts, the only one of 50. Motorcyclists don't have to wear helmets, so I find it a little incongruous that the lawmakers are even thinking about prohibiting people from talking on their cell phones.
Well, go ahead, Joanne. Did you want to add something else in there?
And I just say, I think there are other concerns. So you can't, if you're at a red light, you can't use your phone. You'd have to pull over. So then will we have people pulling over unsafely on highways and perhaps causing accidents because they want to use their phone? Is it even legal to do so on our interstate highways? I think there are lots of questions.
Well, and Norm, I want to turn to you on this as well. The House did pass the bill. That's why the Senate's looking at it now. The Transportation Committee took a look at it this week. How do you think the committee and the fuller Senate is going to feel about this?
Well, there was quite emotional testimony at that hearing by people who either had experienced accidents or had a loved one, and one couple's son had brain damage from someone who was texting. We had the sister and her husband testify about former Amherst fire chief who was killed by a young man who was texting, thought he hit a snowbank.
Yeah, and he was just going out to get his mail. I mean, just the most sort of mundane type of activity.
So, and they basically were saying, you know, it's very dangerous. I think on your intro you had the Greenland police chief talking about how dangerous it is. And she said the law would apply to police officers and firefighters. And she said, it's about time I changed my behavior. We had one person testify that they don't ride a bicycle anymore anywhere on the highway because people are weaving around because they're talking. So I think it made an impact.
All right. Well, coming up, a proposed amendment to New Hampshire's Constitution banning discrimination based on sexual orientation. If passed, we'd be the first state to have this. What do you think of this effort? Is it needed in New Hampshire or not? Let us know coming up. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Winter is hard on your cars, especially in New Hampshire. If you're thinking about upgrading your car, truck, or motorhome this spring, why not donate the old one to NHPR? It's easy. We fill out the paperwork and arrange for the pickup and sale of your vehicle. Just call 1-877-393-NHPR to get things started, or go online to nhpr.org. More of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. It's the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank. Customized business banking for businesses, professionals, municipalities, and not-for-profit organizations online at centrixbank.com. And Northeast Delta Dental, providing dental benefits to businesses of all sizes and individuals throughout New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. Information online at nedelta.com. 920, this is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Here are some of the headlines that we're covering this hour. The Senate examining the death penalty and a House bill to repeal capital punishment. Also, a Senate committee this week took a look at banning handheld cell phone use behind the wheel. We've been talking about that. A little bit later, we'll look at news of a new high-tech aerospace manufacturing facility coming to Rochester. And in just a moment, also taking a look at a proposed amendment to our Constitution banning discrimination based on sexual orientation. You can join us on these headlines and others, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests this week are Joanne McKenzie with the Eagle Tribune. She's New Hampshire editor there. Norma Love with the Associated Press. And Dean Spiliotis, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, let's kick off this part of the show with a political story, a new candidate running for governor. Who is it?
That's right. His name is Walt Havenstein. He is throwing his hat into the ring for the Republican nomination for governor. He has never run for elective office before, so he's not particularly well-known, although people in the business community know him well. He's also been a significant Republican donor and fundraiser, so he's certainly known within Republican politics. He's 64. He's a former CEO of BAE Systems, a very large manufacturer in the state. I think in contrast to the other announced candidate, Andrew Hemingway, who's primarily known as a political activist in the state, he's going to run on a business platform, talking about his experience in the business world, and I think that may sort of help attract some interest to him for him. The biggest issue with him right now that we've read about is this issue of residency. If you're going to run for governor or I think state senator in the state, you have to have residency or domicile, which in itself is a vague concept, for 7 years. When he was working for BAE, he had a condo down in the D.C. area in Maryland, took some tax breaks on that condo, which for some people calls into question where his residency was, because apparently to get this tax credit, you have to have residency in Maryland. He never voted in Maryland, which probably helps his case a bit. He says he's been assured by his lawyers that he can claim residency status here. It's not clear whether Andrew Hemingway has made a little noise about him getting on the ballot. I don't know whether his folks will push this from a ballot perspective. Democrats are just sort of watching at this point, but I think they'll make a big deal out of it at some point if it's not resolved during the Republican primary.
Well, interesting to see another face get into this race. And Joanne McKenzie, what does Mr. Havenstein bring to this Republican race? From what I've read, Republicans are pretty excited about it.
I think they are excited. As far as I can see right now, it's less about what he brings as a candidate and more about his eligibility questions, which echo a little bit what Scott Brown's presumed entry into the U.S. Senate race bring. Is New Hampshire going to be the state where anyone can run for office? You know, you go to Delaware to form a corporation, you go to the Granite State to run a campaign. So while Scott Brown's residency is not a question, Mr. Havenstein certainly is for many, and I think it raises questions about who represents New Hampshire and who's qualified to represent New Hampshire. But I think, you know, Granite State voters have a very, very, very long history of sorting through rhetoric and campaign strategy, and they'll make up their minds whether I think he'll be on the ballot, and I think New Hampshire voters will decide whether it's appropriate that he's there and if they want his business experience in the governor's office.
All right, let's go to our listeners. And then I did want to follow up on briefly on the Scott Brown story that you mentioned, Joanne. The number for you to join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Dean, Norma, Joanne, let's go to our listeners. Cheryl's calling in from Nottingham. Hi, Cheryl. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura. How are you today?
Fine.
Good. The question that I had was regarding repeal of the death penalty. I know one of the largest questions that comes into people's mind, particularly the legislators and others, and certainly our law enforcement, is, you know, the incentive or sort of the disincentive, the death penalty, a deterrent to criminals. Well, I guess if someone was instead on, say, for instance, life imprisonment, our prison system sometimes provides quote-unquote perks, a college education, a law education, et cetera, to prisoners that are not available often to the general public because of the cost of that education. Our own residents often can't afford to go to college. Our own residents oftentimes are homeless and don't get as much food and meals as prisoners do. Is there any way that the prison system can sort of decrease, quote-unquote, some of those perks and make the prison sentence have more of an impact?
Cheryl, I'm not really sure where you're going with the death penalty. I think we had a great conversation yesterday with William Wren, Corrections Commissioner, on some of these issues that you raised, so I appreciate the topic, but where are you going with this on the death penalty?
Well, if the death penalty is repealed, I think some people are concerned that then there's no deterrent to criminals in terms of committing a murder.
I see. And this is a point that came up in the committee hearing this week, Dean. Go ahead.
No, I understand.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Cheryl's point basically is if you're not going to put the individual to death, then there are things that you can do to make their life in prison less comfortable or profitable in terms of education and personal growth. I don't know the answer to that. There are differences in the types of prisons that people can be assigned to, but beyond that, I'm not sure. But I think that's the question. If you're going to repeal it, is there something you can do to make it less pleasant of a life stay for the criminal?
All right. Thank you, Cheryl, for joining us. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. George is calling in from Concord. Hi, George. You're on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. My question pertains to the proposed amendment to the Constitution prohibiting discrimination. I wonder if the proposed amendment defines exactly what discrimination is and if there's any kind of exemption that would allow churches to determine who they're going to ordain and who they're not.
So how do you define discrimination, and is there a sort of faith-based exception, George? Is that what you're asking?
Correct. And my concern would be that the amendment is created and then the courts are left to determine what discrimination is.
And how do you feel about this amendment, George? I'm just curious.
I think that in many things it's appropriate, but what if you only have a room in your house, one room in your house, and you're renting it out? And, you know, is it limiting my right to choose who's going to be there, et cetera, et cetera? So I think that in the broad society with a large corporation, it's perfectly satisfactory. I think when you try to bring it back to a very kind of very tiny micro level, I think then it could become an issue.
Okay.
And violates people's individual rights.
Thanks a lot for calling in, George. And Norm, I did want to ask you about this. This is going to be a big deal. The Senate or the House took a look at this constitutional amendment this week?
The House took a look at it this week. The Senate passed it unanimously.
Unanimously?
What the amendment proposes to do is where you have in the Constitution prohibiting discrimination based on race, creed, sex, national origin, to add sexual orientation. And at the hearing this week in the House, even the gay community was divided because they felt that it should be a different definition, one that recognized gender expression. In other words, transgenders would be encompassed in the amendment. The argument was made that it would not apply in the case our caller mentioned because it wouldn't go to that level of individual. I think we have state laws that protect people who rent out rooms in their homes now anyway. But anytime you have a sexual orientation, people were saying, well, what does that mean going forward? What is the definition? There certainly is an understanding now of what that is. But what will it mean in 10 years or how will the courts enforce it? And I think he has a point there. If there is a conflict in the Constitution, when they have to do a ruling between different provisions, and there haven't been conflicts in the past, it's left to the court to decide.
George, thank you for the call. Dean Spiliotis, from what I understand, if New Hampshire did do this, and there are some questions coming up, like the one George raises, like some of the ones that you presented, Norma, but if this did go through, New Hampshire would be the first to have this on the Constitution. How significant is that?
It would be very significant. It would indeed be the first state to have this kind of amendment to its state constitution. And just to let listeners know, in case they're not familiar with the process, the House needs a 3/5 vote in favor of this for then go on the ballot in November. So voters will have an opportunity to vote on this should it also be passed by the House by the appropriate necessary majority for an amendment to the Constitution. You know, it is interesting because, as Norma mentioned, the state already has prohibitions against discrimination that are in statute, but the idea here is to sort of enshrine it in the Constitution. And I'm, you know, getting to George's point, I think there's always going to be a role for the courts in the future because it is often very difficult to kind of spell out exactly how to deal with all future cases. So, you know, while I'm not as familiar with the specific language, you know, I think there's always going to be some debate over what exactly is meant by orientation.
Okay. Well, George, thanks for the call. And again, we're talking about that proposed constitutional amendment prohibiting discrimination based on sexual orientation. That's before the House, as Norma tells us, already passed the Senate unanimously. We're looking at that. Also, the Senate Judiciary Committee this week, looking at possible repeal of the death penalty, also a bill banning handheld cell phone use, and Walter Havenstein announcing that he's going to run for governor, a businessman. Join us on these headlines and more, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Joanne McKenzie, I did want to ask you about a happy headline from the Seacoast. 400 manufacturing jobs coming to Rochester, about a collaboration of Albany International and a French company, Safran, I'm not quite sure how they pronounce it, Joanne, but this is a big deal. By 2020, there could be 400 to 500 new high-tech manufacturing jobs in Rochester. Put this, Joanne, in the bigger economic picture for the Granite State.
Well, I think, you know, there's long been concern at every level of state government and from residents of the brain drain of young people leaving New Hampshire either for their college education or after their college education, not to return because they're seeking higher skilled, better paid jobs that would allow them to remain here. So I think it's a huge, I mean, the state is putting millions of dollars on the line in the form of a loan for this new deal. And as you said, it's going to be ultimately 400 or 500 skilled jobs to manufacture, I believe it's engine parts.
Yeah, engine parts that will be aircraft fuel efficient and so forth.
And it's relying, the deal is also relying heavily on the state's community college system, that they would partner as well to provide training for a skilled workforce for Safran. And again, skilled, high-quality jobs. The state has long emphasized job skill training in the form of grants, which we see every other week, it seems, that the state's awarding small, often grants to companies that match those grants to provide, solely to provide job training skills for their employees. And this is that magnified many, many fold. So I think it's a real positive move for New Hampshire and may allow us to retain some of our highly intelligent, skilled young people who are fleeing the state's borders in search of, better-paying jobs.
Well, magnified is a good way to put it. Dean, you know this is a big deal. When both U.S. senators make the trip from Washington and the governor shows up, I mean, the politicians love this story.
Absolutely. I thought it was interesting. I think in the opening montage, we heard Kelly Ayotte. Gene Shaheen has also gotten credit for bringing in some of the grant money. You know, this also gets to, if you remember when Maggie Hassan ran for governor, she had her innovation agenda, and a lot of that was about retooling workers and creating opportunities for workers to get the proper education and training for these new kinds of high-tech jobs. I mean, it's sort of been a longstanding goal in the state is to bring in more of these opportunities. So, yeah, absolutely, it's good news, and it sounds like it will continue to build over the next 5 to 10 years there.
Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can join us on some of the headlines that we're following up on our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. 1-800-892-6477. All of you, I think it was Joanne who mentioned Scott Brown earlier and his campaign that has been kind of percolating for a long time here in the Granite State. Finally, Norma Love, Scott Brown has announced that he'll announce next week his campaign for U.S. Senate.
Well, an announcement of announcement of announcement. I mean, I think he's gotten a lot of free publicity. I think he should pay all the outlets something for all the time that he's gotten on this. But if he's going to finally step in, I think that, it's not a surprise. I mean, I think most people had expected it when he went forward with his exploratory committee. He has certainly stirred up the fundraising mechanism for Gene Shaheen big time, who, you know, when the first inkling came forward. But I think there's the forgotten man in this, and that's Jim Rubens. I mean, there's also Karen Testerman and Bob Smith, but Jim Rubens has been all over the state campaigning. I mean, he's had a tour on charter schools. He's trying to go after the people who feel that I guess it, one of Scott Brown's weaknesses, the Second Amendment folks.
That, Jim Rubin's had a Second Amendment tour around the state.
Right. So I think he's trying to stir up interest in his campaign, and he's doing it the grassroots way while Scott Brown is getting the headlines.
Well, and Dean, the speculation, as Norma alluded to, has gone on for months. Lots of free publicity, increased name recognition for former Senator Brown here in the Granite State. Any downside, Dean, to this long and much-examined buildup?
Well, there's always an outside chance of voter fatigue, just kind of getting tired with the sort of waiting for somebody to actually declare that they're going to run for office. So, you know, that may be the case. I still think it's early enough in terms of when the average voter kind of locks into the election, which will probably be sometime over the summer leading into the September primary. So, you know, I think talking about Jim Rubins, there's an old cliche in political coverage that certain candidates or events just kind of suck all the oxygen out of the room for the rest of the folks. And I think that's what's happening with the rest of the field. The reality is, you know, we've been watching this guy now for the better part of a year. We were pretty sure he was going to run. He's going to bring in a tremendous amount of outside money and outside attention. You know, one other potential downside is sort of how irritated conservatives in the party get with him, because there are already some corners of the Republican Party in the state who are unhappy with him. They think he's too moderate. So that's what he really has to worry about. But in terms of the attention, just the reality for those other candidates is as long as he's around, he's going to get the lion's share of the attention.
Well, and Joanne McKenzie, again, your New Hampshire editor for the Eagle Tribune. So covering southern New Hampshire, what's the buzz in the southern tier about Scott Brown, where folks may be especially familiar with former Senator Brown, given that he was, you know, the neighboring state senator?
I'd say the buzz is divided along party lines. Republicans we've spoken to don't have much issue with his move across the border, and they see him as dynamic. He is dynamic. To his credit, yes, he's gotten a lot of free press. I agree with Norma, but he also has been traveling the state relatively tirelessly. He's everywhere. So I don't think his residency is an issue. I think people find him exciting in a way that perhaps they haven't latched on to Bob Smith and Karen Testerman. Jim Rubins has a pretty solid base down here, and people are excited about him and his support, particularly of the Second Amendment rights.
Okay. Well, coming up, Joanne, I'm going to turn to you again for a story that has gone from New Hampshire to national. Nationwide criticism has come down on one New Hampshire high school after its drama club was told not to produce the Broadway hit Sweeney Todd. The demon barber himself would not be pleased. We'll hear from Joanne on that story. And let's hear from you, too. How do you feel about this? 1-800-892-6477. Is Sweeney Todd appropriate for high schoolers or not? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Keep it right here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. The White House claims victory after a health care sign-up surpassed 7 million. GM Chief Mary Barra and the nation's top auto regulator testify on Capitol Hill. Then NATO's chief warns Russian troops are prepared to attack Ukraine. All coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and New Hampshire Magazine, this month featuring New Hampshire's top doctors selected by their peers. New Hampshire Magazine, where New Hampshire comes to you. And Liberty Utilities, sponsors of a button-up New Hampshire Energy Saving Workshop at PSNH's Manchester headquarters, Wednesday, April 9th at 6 p.m. Details at nhsaves.com/events. 940. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. And let's hear from you as we follow up on some of the big headlines around the Granite State this week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests this week are Joanne McKenzie with the Eagle Tribune, Norma Love with the Associated Press, and Dean Spiliotis, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. FridayNewsRoundup.com. And Joanne, I did want to follow up with you. A story from your area. The Timberlane School District got national attention for its decision about the, or it's, I shouldn't say its decision, but its examination, its questioning of whether next year the High School Drama Club should stage the Sondheim musical Sweeney Todd. Now, fill us in on this, because this got lots of attention.
Oh, it did, and it continues to. Yes, last week the Timberlane School Administration announced that it was canceling the Timberlane Players' production of Sweeney Todd, scheduled for 2015, a year from now. And the superintendent, Earl Metzler, said that he was looking for a, quote, all-inclusive performance that everyone in the community could enjoy, and that Sweeney Todd did not fit the bill. The decision was made by a group of administrators. The superintendent said that took 6 months to make that decision, and they announced it a week ago, Monday, that they were canceling the production. This was not, I want to be very clear, this was a watered-down, a high school edition of the script, rated PG, so it was designed to be appropriate for high school productions. Interestingly, Windham High School, just across the county, is staging Sweeney Todd this spring.
Oh, really? Okay. So,
yeah. And the administration there has said, you know, they don't have concerns, and they're fine with it. They've had conversations. So what happened after this announcement, the students and many parents and alumni and, yes, Broadway and beyond, responded outraged that the school administrators would have made this decision. So there was a public forum on Wednesday night at the high school where students, parents, community members, theater professionals were given an opportunity to address the administration and to voice their support. They could have voiced their support for the decision, but they all voiced their support for a reconsideration of that decision and to allow the play to go forward. There has not been an announcement. The administrative team took the comments under advisement, and we expect an announcement either possibly today, but more likely early next week, of whether they will reverse their decision and allow the play to move forward.
Well, very interesting. And Dean Spiliotis, your daughter's involved in school theater productions. Now, for people who don't know, this is kind of a, icky subject. Sweeney Todd is this crazy barber, and he kills his customers and then turns them into pies.
That's right.
And but, you know, people, theater goers love this show. I haven't seen it myself because I don't really want to see that. But people do love this. It's a classic, and it's very successful.
Yes. And as you note, I am a drama dad, so I'm intimately acquainted with this sort of stuff. And whenever a new play is announced that our daughter might take part in, my wife and I always try to figure out, well, how are they going to adapt it for the kids? And as Joanne, I think, mentioned, these high school and junior high plays are always watered down in terms of their content. So it's typically not anything to worry about. This whole thing reminds me a little bit of Footloose, where they wouldn't let the kids dance. I'm interested to see. I'd be surprised if they don't reverse course on this. This is one of those things.
Given the outcry.
Yeah,
that
this is
describes.
One of those things where I'm sure the superintendent just did not think through, in the age of social media, like what this decision would mean in terms of the ramifications. I mean, it's tailor made for people to weigh in from all over the country. So, sometimes as an administrator, you make a decision, you don't think about all the ramifications. You know, to tell high school students that they have to do a play that is suitable for children, I might take a little bit of issue with that, and I think some people are. You know, he wants a sort of community standards argument. I'm not sure that's the role for a high school play.
Said at the hearing that Joanne mentioned, look, if you don't want to see the play,
right,
don't go see it.
Right. But to use children as a standard by which you select a high school play, to me, doesn't seem, as someone who's been involved in this area for a while now, it just doesn't seem to be the strongest argument, and I just think they didn't think it was going to blow up like this. But I'm not at all surprised. And again, these plays are always tailored for high school and junior high players.
Yes, they have definitely. They have the Broadway version, and
then
they're
often called,
you know,
Sweeney Todd Junior or
exactly,
something like that.
Right? Exactly. Well, as you said, Dean, a lot of folks are weighing in on social media. If you want to weigh in the next couple minutes about this Sweeney Todd debate at Timber Lane, we'd love to hear from you. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Norma, I did want to turn to you on something that just broke yesterday. John DeStazo, the union leader's loss, is the New Hampshire Journal's gain. DeStazo is one of the leading political reporters in New Hampshire. Iconic, the New Hampshire Journal called him. Quite a catch for the Journal.
Well, you know, the union leader has, over the past few years, cut salaries. They've laid people off. They don't have very many people left in their newsroom who are staff. And I think there's a sense in that newsroom that is the paper stable. And I think for John, he has, just like a lot of us, financial commitments. And if your salary's been cut and you get an offer, why not? I mean, I think that was his only job out of college, was being there, build up a political reporter. His column is read by everybody every
30
week.
30 years, yeah. Around the country, especially
around
country. presidential primaries.
And I think what the New Hampshire Journal is hoping is that he will bring that knowledge and his sources, which he has many, to them. And I guess kudos to them.
Well, you said something, Norma, that people who aren't involved in the news business might not understand. You said the union leader has very few people left who are staff. Now, people see the headlines and they think, okay, that's staff.
No. Gary Rayner, who's on this show every other week, was laid off, and they hired him back part-time. So a lot of that seems to be the nature of our industry now, is to shed responsibilities and debt and any risk that you have in terms of, for a lot of people, pensions or I think Gary does get some of that. So I guess their part-timers do get – I don't know the whole way they lay that out for people, but John was staff, but one of the few left who you could say he is a member of the union leader's staff. But you'll see in their paper bylines correspondent. That's a whole different category. And I think there are
kind of like adjunct professors that we hear
about
in academia.
There are other newspapers and outlets around the country and our industry. It should be no surprise that just like everybody else, it's going through upheaval, and that managers and even the Associated Press is trying to find – everyone's trying to find ways to deal with the new world of mobile phones being your source of newspapers instead of newspapers, of dealing with people reading on laptops, of a whole new world of how things news is generated and transformed into the ear or to the eye. And how do you pay for that?
Yeah, New Hampshire Journal, again, is an online publication.
It's an online
correct?
Publication.
Yeah. Your thoughts, too, and I don't want to put you in an uncomfortable position, Joanne, but there you are, you know, in print media. I just wonder what you think about this.
About DeStazo's move? Or
yes, it's a big deal. Both or either, yeah.
Yeah, I hesitate to speak to the condition of the union leader newsroom. All newsrooms, as Norma said, are struggling. Newspapers are struggling as we reinvent ourselves and figure out how we still deliver the same quality reporting and product in new and different ways and multiple ways, multiple platforms that we're all struggling to do. So, yeah, I think it's definitely a coup for the New Hampshire Journal, but I'm also confident that the union leader will survive without John DeStazo.
Okay. Well, and I wanted to turn to you, Dean Spiliotis, a story out of Dartmouth where you worked for a time. Sit-ins this week at the Ivy League school. What are Dartmouth students sitting in about? And it's still pretty cold to do a sit-in, by the way, although the weather has gotten better.
Oh, this is an interesting story. You know, and as you mentioned, 35 students up at Dartmouth staged a good old-fashioned, old-school sit-in where Norm and I were saying it felt like we're back during the Vietnam War. These 35 students sat in at Parkhurst Hall, which is the main building on the green where the president has his office, and they proposed a freedom budget, which was a list of 70 demands, all dealing with different forms of diversity, faculty and minority student recruitment, curricular changes, financial aid and residential life changes. The administration has had some response to it. The students were not not happy with the response. I'm not sure if they're still sitting in there or if this was sort of a limited in time, but it is interesting to see that kind of grassroots political activism taking place. It's a time-honored tradition in universities of sitting in when you're unhappy with the administration. You know, a lot of it, again, focused on increasing enrollment of Black, Latino, Native American students, I think by 10%, and also increasing faculty recruitment of minority faculty. You know, as you said, I taught up there for a number of years, and I saw firsthand there are some real difficulties in terms of culture, geography, just sort of what's going on up there. Although the area has grown over the last 20 years in getting people to stay up there, and I think it's a problem. They struggled with it when I was there. They're going to continue to struggle with it. Although it sounds like these students, if nothing else, and they have been told that they're violating college policy. But if nothing else, they seem to have gotten the administration's attention, and we'll sort of see where it goes from here.
Norma, do you want to jump in on that?
Oh, it's a time-honored tradition. Back when I was at the University of California, Berkeley, it was, as Dean just said.
I bet you they had a lot of sit-ins there.
Yeah, but, you know, there were demonstrations in Sproul Plaza. You know, I'm at that time, I wasn't involved, and I was the still starting my observer period as a journalist, I guess. But, you know, it was just one of those things you did as a student was to say, why are you doing this? And at that time, I remember we had demonstrations where they tear gassed the campus. And if you left Berkeley and went out into the valley, it was like going into a whole nother world. So it's very insular. It's what you're doing is getting the attention of the people right there. But quite often, that's as far as it goes.
Well, and as much as we love all the stories that we cover on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, Joanne McKenzie, I did want to throw this last one to you because we really love this story. It has to do with backyard chickens for Manchester residents. And we actually got a Facebook comment from Manchester, New Hampshire residents for backyard chickens. So there's no name here. This is the group. This group wrote, "Here in Manchester, we have mixed feelings about the amendment that is being passed. As Alderman Osborne said on Tuesday at the Board of Aldermen meeting, the restrictive nature of this amendment means that very few Manchester residents will be able to keep hens if it's passed as it stands. We are pushing for reducing the square footage limit to 5,000 square feet, reduce the 20-foot setback requirement, open this to multifamily, non-owner-occupied properties, in other words, apartment buildings." I want to thank the group for posting that comment on our Facebook page. And just to let people know, Joanne, they did say in Manchester, yeah, you can do backyard chickens, but only if you have half an acre. So you want to peck at that story, Joanne?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yes, at least half an acre, and that would only allow you to have up to 6 hens in Manchester. But this is an issue that people are flocking to, forgive me, all over southern New Hampshire and the rest of the state. Recently, a couple of weeks ago, this New Hampshire Agriculture in the Classroom program, we wrote a story about they have taken on chickens as this year's topic. Now, this is supported by the Ag Department, and they go around to Granite State Elementary Schools and teach children about the importance of agriculture in their lives. And this year, it just happens to be chickens, which is appropriate because so many towns are dealing with either drafting ordinances regarding livestock, specifically fowl, or amending the ordinances they have. And they vary dramatically from community to community. In Salem, New Hampshire, you have to have 5 acres to keep chickens.
5 acres? Wow, that's a lot.
Which is extraordinary. Nearby in Windham, where you might think they'd require 10, they actually, several years ago, loosened their requirements. It had been a 2-acre minimum for chickens, and they made it much easier for people to keep chickens. Derry right now is struggling with its ordinance and is likely to approve some changes to that. Kingston, the planning board there for several years, has tried to restrict livestock/fowl. And the voters have said no repeatedly. Let us keep our chickens. Think that it's there was also a state law change a couple of years ago. I think it was 2012. Prior to that, in New Hampshire, you had to buy a minimum of 12 chicks at one time. So that prevented probably some backyard chicken farmers who wanted a couple of chickens. Now you can buy as many or as few as you wish. And I think it speaks not to necessarily the economics, but more people's interest in knowing where their food is coming from, particularly with chickens, which chicken farms probably correctly get a bad rap nationally for how chickens' layers are kept and the conditions under which they produce the eggs that we all consume. So I think it's wonderful that New Hampshire, which does have agricultural roots that we're losing sight of, has put chickens on the front burner.
Well, it does, yeah, and it does feed into this whole local food movement. It's not just country folk who want to have a hand in, you know, knowing where the food is coming from and having a little more control over that. So thanks to those folks for the comment. And next week on The Exchange, we'll be looking at a recent report on New Hampshire's housing infrastructure, how it doesn't fit our state's changing demographics. The authors of a new report warn this could be an economic drag on our state. So that's going to be really interesting. That's some of what we're up to next week. How about you, Norma?
Well, back to work at the legislature. They're going to have a hearing on the proposal that the Senate passed on the gas tax. And they're also going to have a hearing on gambling.
So you're over at the House next week.
Over at, yes, at the House, I'm sorry.
Right, the House is looking at the gas tax.
And the gambling.
And at gambling. Once again, we're going to be looking at gambling too, if not next week, then the week after. Joanne, how about you, real quick, what are you going to be following up on next week?
This afternoon, Jean Shaheen, Attorney General Joe Foster, and Salem Police Chief Paul Donovan are hosting a roundtable on the heroin issue in New Hampshire, specifically in southern New Hampshire. So we'll be looking into that, what the state provides for people struggling with addiction who want to get into recovery,
okay,
and what the state's role could be there.
That's a big issue that we've been talking about a lot on The Exchange. Dean Spiliotis, how about you?
Yeah, I'll add in these two political stories now, Walt Havenstein and Scott Brown, both ramping things up. Sounds like we're going to have a real race for governor for the primary, and be nice to see Scott Brown formally get in so we can stop speculating about whether he's going to get in.
Right. All right. Well, I want to thank all of you for being with us on the roundup this week. It was good to see all of you and hear about some of these headlines. And for those of you who may be in the mood for backyard chicken farming, given what's happening around the state, this one's for you.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with a look at Afghanistan as results shake out from its elections and as U.S. troops prepare to withdraw. Then a new report shows New Hampshire's housing infrastructure doesn't fit our changing demographics. And with dire predictions about climate change, more attention is being paid to how communities will adapt to future severe weather. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
I am Reem Show, next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where we get support from you, our listeners. And support also comes to us from the City of Claremont. Information about Claremont's economic development initiatives and business relocation at ClaremontNH.com. And from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank. Banking solutions customized to your business. Information available at CentrixBank.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN,
Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. The unemployment rate remains unchanged at 6.7%. Another shooting at Fort Hood raises new questions about security on military bases. In the biggest campaign finance case in Citizens United, the Supreme Court